Then we are ready to proceed with Ingram versus Cain.
May it please the court, my name is Victor Boog, attorney number 2561, appearing on behalf of the appellants, Dwight Ingram and Frederick E. As this court is aware, this is the second time this has been up before the Court of Appeals. First time, the Court of Appeals decided that the shareholder agreement in section 11B that was ambiguous. And the court pointed out that the word directors was interpreted in two different ways. What I'd like to focus on is what happened the first time around and how it is we got here a second time. First time around, Judge Berrio, the trial judge, found the language in paragraph or section 11B awkward. He didn't specifically say, as I recall, it was ambiguous, but that's basically how it was interpreted. But it wasn't based upon looking at 11B exclusively and only. When you go back and look at the findings of the judge in the original case, he looked at the entire shareholders agreement and concluded that it was an agreement that was generally put together to protect minority interests, my client's interests. But more importantly, as set forth in page 2 of my opening brief, the trial court interpreted the shareholders' agreement to require removal of any director on the board who was not a shareholder, not simply on the language in 11B, and not simply on the language in the shareholders' agreement as a whole. Judge Berrio acknowledged the testimony of Mr. Ingram in paragraph 11, that paragraph 11 was very important to him because it protected him as a minority shareholder so that the majority shareholder could not drain company revenues. That's a specific quote out of the judge's determinations. He went on to say that Mr. Egan's testimony, that from the beginning it was understood by all that you must be a shareholder to be a director, he gave credit to that as well, because he specifically commented that the testimony of those two gentlemen was credible. And he went on to say, I think that is the purpose and was the purpose of Section 11, protect minority shareholders. So there was a lot of extrinsic evidence in the trial itself. And it was a lot of extrinsic evidence, along with the language of the shareholders' agreement in totality, that caused Judge Berrio to determine that my clients were entitled to be on this board and that that you had to be a shareholder to stay on this board. So it was sent back for a hearing if necessary on extrinsic evidence. Neither party put on their clients with respect to anything different from what was originally testified to with respect to extrinsic evidence. There was only one witness called, and that was the alleged scrivener of paragraph 11B, Robert Houston. Now the allegation is from the opponents in this case that, and the court found that Mr. Houston's testimony was competent, extrinsic evidence. And I submit to the court today that it was anything but that. The cases cited for Scrivener's testimony being competent evidence, extrinsic evidence, and there's three or four such cases cited by opposing counsel. In each case, the person who testified as a lawyer had personal knowledge of what the intent of the parties was, either because the parties appeared in front of that person and told them expressly what their intent was, or because the matter was discussed and it was the language in the document was included with everybody's knowledge. And as a result, the scrivener really had personal information that would support competent evidence on behalf of such a person. So what was that competent evidence with respect to Mr. Houston? He testified that he doesn't remember ever meeting with these people, ever talking with them on the phone, ever getting any correspondence in mail letters, any kind of testimony from these people as to what their intent was at all. Absolutely none. So why was he allowed to testify? Well, he testified about the fact because he at least inherited this job to create this document, the shareholders agreement, which had been started by other senior partners of this firm, and he inherited as a younger partner, maybe not even a partner in the firm, and his job was to finish this project, and he apparently did write 11B. He testified at trial that he had never prepared a shareholders agreement that provided the protection for minority shareholders that this shareholders agreement included. He further testified that he had never used the language 11B in any other document he had ever written, and he admitted candidly that I can see why it is ambiguous. The trial court not only relied upon the testimony of Mr. Houston, but further indicated that it was convinced that the word shareholder at the outset of the agreement could only have applied to the three individuals who were then shareholders at the time. Basically, the trial judge found the second time around that it wasn't ambiguous anymore to him because the word shareholder had a specific and limited meaning. I submit that that was not what was supposed to happen on remand, but more importantly, shareholder cannot be so limited in its interpretation because Section 9E of this shareholders agreement specifically says that anybody who becomes a shareholder of this company must sign this shareholders agreement and i.e. become a party to the shareholders agreement. That's black and white. Now this court said there was a problem with the word director and whether or not director was limited to the three individuals in subparagraph 11A, or it could be applied to any director then or later. I submit that there are circumstances in which the word director, and it was prefaced by the word any director, if it was to be limited to the three people whose name appeared above, simple language could have said that. It could have expressly said that, and it didn't. More importantly, there are situations in which other directors, other than Mr. Cuddihy's wife and child, could have been made directors of this because there was a provision that the board could be expanded from three to five directors. It may have been that if a person who was really interested in this company and everybody agreed to that, and they all agreed that this person could become a director, that person could also become a shareholder by agreement of my clients. And if such a person became a director and later decided he didn't want to be a shareholder anymore and for whatever reason gave up his stock, whether he died or whether he just said, I'm out of here, that person, any director would apply to him. If he wasn't a shareholder, he wasn't going to be on that board anymore. So there were ways to identify who might be a director beyond the three people expressly identified in 11A. For those reasons, we submit that this case should have been decided on remand the same way it was decided by Judge Berryhill the first time around. He'd already weighed in that my client's testimony was credible and that this was a document that was to protect minority shareholders, and nothing had changed. The only thing that happened was an attorney came in and said, geez, I never wrote a shareholder agreement in that fashion. And Judge Berryhill was, for that reason, impressed with the intent of the drafter of one provision of this document. And I submit that's not enough to make that credible evidence. But I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court, Lauren Moss Thompson, 41429, on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Cuddihy. Your Honors, I would just like to point out for the court as a threshold matter that the standard of review applicable today is whether the decision of the trial court in favor of Mr. Cuddy was so clearly erroneous as to find no support in the record.
Counsel, I want to interrupt you right there. It doesn't look to me like the court made factual findings here, which the clearly erroneous standard would apply to. It appears that the court relied on provisions of the agreement, specifically the opening paragraph that talked about shareholders with a capital S. And that was it. I mean, the attorney didn't testify to any party's intent here, and there's no finding that the attorney did so.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with both aspects of that commentary. In the first regard, what the trial court actually found was that this court found the agreement was ambiguous as a matter of law and remanded for the trial court to hear further evidence. What the trial court heard was the testimony of Mr. Houston, and the court did make factual findings with regard to the credibility of Mr. Houston's testimony.
But what did that witness say specifically about anybody's intent with respect to the provisions at issue in this case?
What Mr. Houston said was, while he didn't remember the content of specific conversations he had with the parties, he did recall the circumstances surrounding the negotiation of the shareholders' agreement. And specifically, what Mr. Houston testified in that regard. Was as follows. In response to the trial court's question about whether the election provision of the agreement was intended to require that additional directors other than the parties also hold stock in the company, Mr. Houston testified, "I do not have recollection of having that issue. I was not addressing that issue with this section, that additional board members had to be shareholders. I don't even recall anything close to that happening because these three shareholders were the three shareholders I was dealing with." So while Mr. Houston admittedly did not recall the content of any particular conversations he had with the parties, he did again recall certain factual instances and circumstances surrounding the negotiation of the agreement. Additionally, because this court must pay attention to all evidence in the record that was also before the trial court, I would like to bring to the court's attention the fact that Mr. Houston's recollection of the limited scope of the election provision was confirmed by another contemporaneous document that is also in the record. And that is what I refer to as the consent agreement that was submitted as plaintiff's trial exhibit 14. And that was the agreement by which the shareholders' agreement was expressly adopted, because the shareholders' agreement had never been formally signed by the parties. And similar to the shareholders' agreement, the consent agreement defines capital S shareholders as the undersigned, constituting all of the shareholders of Interstate Transportation Incorporated. And consistent with Mr. Houston's testimony that Cuddy, Ingram, and Egan were the only three individuals that the parties contemplating serving on ITI's board of directors at that time, the consent agreement also states, quote, "resolved that as of the date hereof, Edward Cuddy, Frederick W. Egan, and Dwight Ingram be, and each of them hereby is approved, ratified, and confirmed as all of the members of the board of directors to serve in such capacity and to vote earlier resignation or removal."
Counsel, you just said that the only parties contemplated to be directors were the three original shareholders, but 11A contemplates expressly expansion of the board as possible from 3 to 5. How could that occur if directors, under your interpretation, must be shareholders with a capital S, who can only be the three original shareholders? Under your interpretation, there can never be more than three. Never.
There can be, Your Honor, and the only way to reconcile that scenario is if directors other than the original three do not have to be shareholders. While the shareholders agreement as a whole does contemplate the addition of new shareholders at some point in time, it doesn't resolve the ambiguity that the trial court was faced with, because the shareholders agreement doesn't explain how new shareholders then become subject to the terms of the agreement.
Well, 9E says that they agree to it and sign it. That's how they become shareholders, and they sign it. When they sign it, why aren't they undersigned shareholders?
If you actually look at the format of the shareholders agreement itself, the opening paragraph of the agreement states, "The shareholders agreement is dated effective as the date set forth on the signature page by and among the undersigned shareholders," which is defined as the capital S shareholders. So the date on the signature page that's germane to the definition of capital S shareholders is dated April 1st, 2003. So no other shareholders that were added at any point in time after the fact could have been the undersigned parties effective April 1st, 2003. And in fact, the shareholders' agreement does contain a blank signature page following the initial signature page that has a date blank with spaces presumably for new shareholders to sign on to the agreement. However, nothing in the agreement provides that by merely signing this additional signature page, any future shareholders would then, by definition, become capital S shareholders.
All right, but the agreement has, and I've counted them, more than a dozen provisions in it, dealing with rights and responsibilities of shareholders, and in each occasion uses the capital S. So in your interpretation, any new shareholder would not be bound by that, those provisions, is that correct?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that that's precisely the ambiguity that exists in this document.
Well, let me get this straight. You're saying for one purpose, capital S shareholders means something, and now you're denying that it means that very thing with respect to the entire agreement.
Your Honor, if I may, this court had in front of it on the prior appeal all of the terms that we're now discussing when it held this agreement to be ambiguous as a matter of law.
But nobody brought up the initial paragraph. In fact, the trial judge on remand noted that this was kind of newly discovered. Nobody had brought this up before. And nobody had brought up, I've looked at the briefs, nobody brought up 9E. Nobody brought up those things.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. The first being, there actually is a use in the agreement of lowercase s shareholders. And that appears in Section 8 of the agreement with regard to the inscriptions that need to appear on certificates of stock. So yeah. When new stock is issued.
And that's it. That's the exception that proves the rule, because elsewhere the capital is used throughout the agreement. And I get back to my question. If the capital S shareholders means only the three people that originally signed it, under your interpretation, all of those other provisions to which the capital S shareholders term is used would not apply to new shareholders. Isn't that the necessary implication of your argument?
No, Your Honor. I think that that highlights the ambiguity in the agreement, in that the agreement itself, while it contemplates the addition of new shareholders, it doesn't say how those shareholders actually become subject to the agreement. And particularly, the reason why we're here today is because the question is whether the parties actually contemplated that directors had to be shareholders. And merely because the agreement makes reference to the addition of new shareholders in some capacity by signing on to the agreement, becoming subject to the agreement, does not answer the question of did the party sit down and think, we want all future directors to be shareholders of this company. And the evidence that Mr. Houston testified to on remand was that parties didn't contemplate that scenario because that wasn't the issue they were faced with. The issue they were faced with at the time of entering into this agreement is what are the rights among the three of them. So I would also like to point out for the court that to the extent the trial court did note that capital S shareholders added further clarity with regard to its conclusion on the document, it used the term corroborated. So the court actually found that it found Mr. Houston's credible as a factual finding, and then said that its determination was corroborated by this use of capital S shareholders in the agreement as referring to only the original three.
Counsel, let me give you another scenario under this agreement. Let's say that the existing shareholders, the three of them, agreed to transfer shares to some other person, such that at the conclusion of that transaction, the original shareholders together no longer have a majority of the shares. The bylaws expressly require that in electing directors that there be a majority vote, majority defined as one share, one vote. Okay, so under that scenario, the original shareholders would have less than 50%. The bylaws require more than 50% vote to get a director. You could never even have a director. They could all vote for one person and they could all have, say, 49%. You would have no directors.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that, in that the shareholders' agreement amended the bylaws, and that would be an inconsistency between the two documents where I think the shareholders' agreement would govern.
And the shareholders' agreement doesn't say anything about majority vote or anything like that. It doesn't affect those provisions.
It does, Your Honor, and in fact, that supports our interpretation of the document, in that if capital S shareholders, as it's used in the election provision, only refers to these three original gentlemen, then regardless of the fact that certain of the shares have been transferred away, these three gentlemen would still be in a position to control the board and elect individuals to the board. And I think that that actually is consistent with plaintiff's interpretation of the document, to the extent that it was designed to protect them in negotiating this document, the existing parties.
Let me see if I can pin you down on this. Are you saying that capital S shareholders means one thing with respect to 11B, but with respect to all these other provisions in the agreement, it might mean something else?
No, Your Honor, I think capital S shareholders is a clear indication at the time of entering into this document, the parties were only contemplating their rights with regard to themselves. And while they did, there is evidence in the record and based on the language of the document that it occurred to them that they might add some shareholders in the future. They didn't specifically sit down and think, oh, we want all additional directors to also hold shares in the company. I don't think they thought it through. As Mr. Houston testified, that wasn't the issue they were faced with, and they were just trying to establish the rights among the three of them. So I agree with you that there are inconsistencies in the document with regard to parties signing on and parties becoming shareholders. But if the parties had contemplated this scenario that we're faced with here today when the document was drafted from the outset, then we wouldn't see these inconsistencies in the document. The document would set forth more specific provisions as to how additional shareholders come on and in what manner they become subject to the document. But it doesn't say that. It just says they sign on to the document and then they're subject to it with no explanation whatsoever.
Well, why does there have to be an explanation? I mean, that's pretty straightforward. You get shares, then you must sign the agreement, and you become subject to it. What's needed beyond that?
Exactly the reason that we're here today. We're here today because we don't know what happens when additional shareholders sign on to the company, because the agreement doesn't tell us. We don't know what happens when they want to increase the board, because the agreement doesn't tell us. And the reason why it doesn't tell us is because that wasn't an issue that the parties were faced with or even considered at the time they entered into this agreement.
So aren't we left then with just what the agreement says? And it does contemplate expansion of the board from 3 to 5. It does contemplate other shareholders could obtain shares. And don't we, just based on that, have to say, we're just going to look at what the thing says, whether they were what they were thinking about at the time, since they weren't thinking about these specific issues, doesn't matter. We just have to look at the four corners.
We can't, Your Honor, for two reasons. One is the division of this court found that the agreement was ambiguous as a matter of law. So already the Court of Appeals has spoken to the fact that you can't look at the four corners to answer those questions. And another reason is the testimony of Mr. Houston is instructive as to the issues that the parties were presented with at that time, and their intentions in entering into the agreement can't speak to resolve the issue that is before us today. And in fact, Mr. Ingram's testimony that the plaintiffs often rely on at trial, Mr. Ingram testified that he wanted to be able to comment on distributions as a member of the board. Well, Mr. Ingram is on the board as long as he wants to. He can't be removed from the board. So nothing about directors holding shares in the stock would deprive Mr. Ingram of his ability to comment on distributions. Additionally, Mr. Egan testified that he never understood the shareholders agreement, even at the time that it was entered into. So there wasn't any evidence presented at trial that that the trial court could have used to resolve the ambiguity, because none of the parties presented evidence that would have been credible as to that issue. On the other hand, Mr. Houston testified that the parties were only concerned with their own rights among the three of them, and that's precisely the testimony it relied on to resolve the ambiguity. And I would also like to point out to the court, at no point during Mr. Houston's testimony did they object to the fact that he only had limited recollection of the occurrences. And at no point during his testimony did they object on the grounds that he wasn't competent to testify due to his lack of recollection. So I would like to pose to this court that issue wasn't even preserved for review here, because at no point in the record from the trial court did plaintiff state any of those grounds for this court to disregard Mr. Houston's testimony. Not to mention, I'd like to point out for the court that the amount of weight the trial court chose to afford to Mr. Houston's testimony under the circumstances is a matter of the trial court's discretion. And in support of that statement, I would cite to the case Vlaskis v. Murray, 646 P. 2nd 907 911, Colorado Supreme Court, 1982. And in that case, the Colorado Supreme Court found that although the defendant doctor did not have any independent recollection of whether he informed the plaintiff patient about the risks inherent in a surgery the doctor performed on the plaintiff, the court found it was within the trial court's discretion to allow the doctor to present evidence of his habit or routine of informing other patients of such risks under similar circumstances. And in so holding, the Supreme Court articulated, in a case of doubt as to what a person has done, it may be considered more probable that he has done what he has been in the habit of doing than that he acted otherwise. And as discussed in our answer brief at pages 6 through 8, Mr. Houston also testified that in construing the shareholders agreement to require that all directors must hold stock in ITI is inconsistent with his understanding of his own drafting and contrary to his years of experience as a transactional attorney. He also testified that the interpretation advanced by plaintiffs was contrary to his experience in drafting at least 50 other shareholders' agreements. And he testified that had the parties requested that the agreement require that all directors of ITI be shareholders, Mr. Houston would have taken additional steps to obtain the party's consent to such an arrangement, which he did not do.
But he didn't testify that he drafted this agreement in accordance with how he drafted all other agreements. In fact, he said, I don't recall anything about this agreement at all.
He didn't recall the content of specific conversations he had had with the parties.
And he didn't recall drafting it. So that Blaskis case you just cited, it doesn't seem to have any import here. He didn't say, well, I drafted this the same way I drafted all the other ones, so I presume I would have drafted it the same. He had no recollection of this one a bit. He just didn't.
He recalled the circumstances surrounding the negotiations and the agreement, and his recollection was that he had never written the shareholders' agreement to provide for this minority veto power the plaintiffs are now reading into the agreement. So I would disagree with the statement that he didn't recall anything about it. Actually, what he testified was he didn't recall the content of certain conversations. But I still think that he presented credible testimony to the trial court, not only about the negotiations, but also about his regular practices in how he would approach the issue had the parties actually contemplated that directors must be shareholders at the time they were negotiating the agreement. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Boog, I think you have a few more minutes.
I apologize to the court. I mentioned section 9E. Actually, I meant paragraph 9, not the subparagraph E. There's no subparagraphs there. And I'd like to read the relevant statement in paragraph 9 of the shareholders agreement. It says, in pertinent part, any person who shall hereafter acquire any shares of the stock, whether by purchase, gift, or otherwise, shall thereupon automatically become a party to this agreement and shall be subject to all the terms and conditions of this agreement. And such person shall be required to affix his signature indicating the date thereof in the space provided at the end of this agreement. That's why I said that the word shareholder at the beginning of this is not limited to three people. Mr. Houston did recall that he knew about these three gentlemen at the outset was that they didn't get along very well. And he also testified that based thereon, he would have assumed that if Mr. Cudahy thought he had the right to basically add his wife and son to this board and do the things he tried to do later, many years later, he had done so without waiting. And in this case, these parties proceeded from 2003 to 2009 without incident. Nobody was added to the board. No attempt was made by Mr. Cudahy to put his son and daughter on this board. And in fact, he testified at trial. He didn't challenge my client's position with respect to what this agreement was all about. And it was to protect them. The only time he tried to make a change was when he was being challenged for some improper conduct in terms of taking monies that he wasn't entitled to, and then he tried to get rid of my clients. And that's what this is all about. So for all those reasons, and mainly because Mr. Houston could not add any real extrinsic evidence about the intent of these parties. The court had no business doing an about face on what it had done earlier because of the actual testimony that Judge Berryhill cited and attributed to my clients with respect to the purpose of this document, the shareholders' agreement. Counsel said, well, there are other things that people testified to, but those other things weren't made findings of fact by Judge Berryhill the first time around. He relied upon what my client said and his determination that the purpose of this agreement was to provide minority shareholder protection. And the only way to make sure that happened was to make sure not only that Mr. Cuddy couldn't stack this board, but that he couldn't thereafter keep his wife and son on this board unless they were shareholders. And the irony is that this document, the sheriff's agreement, was so tight that he didn't even have the right to give them by gift any shares. And the irony also is that when we brought this lawsuit, Mr. Cudahy really showed his own stripes. We alleged that neither his son or wife were shareholders, because we thought that was key. And he denied that. And why would he deny it? Because he thought it also. Later, he had to admit that they weren't shareholders, and then he had to change his argument that they didn't have to be in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to do something a bit unusual. I have a question I forgot to ask counsel for the appellees. So I'm going to, we won't run the clock. Do you have a copy of the shareholders agreement in front of you?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you please take a look at paragraph 8 of the shareholders agreement?
Yes, sir.
All right. I have a question about the last portion of that that starts with, if any shareholder with a capital S shall acquire any shares of the stock hereafter, etc., and then talks about certifications. This is the marking of certificates. Again, capital S shareholders, but it talks of acquiring shares hereafter. How can that be squared with the notion that capital S shareholders only means the original shareholders?
Well, Your Honor, the agreement contemplates that individual shareholders, these three individuals, can also acquire additional shares of stock. So what that provision speaks to is when these shareholders acquire additional shares of stock. And if you...
This talks about, it starts with each stock certificate issued by the company. That's how the provision starts. It doesn't say to the original shareholders. It says each certificate of stock issued. This is a general provision dealing with the marking of share certificates. And it appears to be limited to capital S shareholders, whatever that is. But if other people can acquire stock, how can capital S shareholders not be referring to them?
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at the difference between paragraph 8 and paragraph 9, paragraph 8 talks generally about the marking of certificates, and actually the last sentence of that paragraph that the court points to, any certificates issued by the company for the purpose of replacing or otherwise with respect to certificates now held or subsequently acquired by any shareholder shall be similarly endorsed. So that paragraph addresses when the existing shareholders acquire new stock in addition to the stock that they're presently holding.
All right, so your position is paragraph 8 doesn't apply, even though it's just a generic marking provision. It doesn't apply to stock certificates acquired by other persons.
Well, it does by virtue of paragraph 9, which is entitled Additional Shares and Shareholders. And what that addresses is when third parties acquire stock, the stock that the third parties acquire, then the provision refers back to the inscription on the stock certificates that's referenced in paragraph 8.
But the additional, as you point out, paragraph 9 says additional shareholders, capital S shareholders.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's a paragraph title. It also appears in bold. But nothing in the actual text of paragraph 9 uses the term capital S shareholders, because that provision specifically refers to third parties as opposed to the three individuals, and incorporates by reference the inscription that needs to appear on the stock issued to third parties in paragraph 8. So when paragraph 8 is looked at in combination with paragraph 9, paragraph 8 is somewhat generic, but also refers to the existing three shareholders' ability to acquire stock other than that they held as of the time of entering into this agreement. And paragraph 9 refers to third parties acquiring new stock. And that reading is actually particularly appropriate in light of the circumstances of the parties actually entering into this agreement, which was a shift of the ownership in the company. Each of the three parties had previously owned one-third of the outstanding stock, and in conjunction with the execution of the shareholders agreement, Mr. Cudahy became a two-thirds owner, and the plaintiff's stock ownerships were reduced. So it would be very reasonable for the parties at this time, given the ownership shift that was going on contemporaneously with the execution of this document, to contemplate that they might change their ownership interests a little bit more at some point in the near or far future.
Yes, but it talks about any person, not any shareholder, hereafter acquire any shares of stock.
And where are you looking at?
Paragraph nine, right in the middle.
Yes, exactly. So paragraph nine is the provision that refers to third parties and doesn't use the capital S shareholders in that paragraph anywhere other than its bold and paragraph titled section, as compared to paragraph eight, which refers to the capital S shareholders as individuals who could acquire additional stock or have their stock replaced, which would necessarily be existing shareholders, as in the three parties.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Can't believe this is an issue. We'll issue an opinion.